The following talk was given by
Steve Matushak
at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on May 12, 2019. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Good morning. Nice to see you all. Happy Mother's Day. Today is a day that is set aside for us to spend some time with our mothers, to reflect upon motherhood, spend time with our families. And when I realized it was Mother's Day that I was going to be giving this talk, initially I thought, well, now is the time to teach the Mother of Wisdom, which is the Great Heart Sutra, which is one of the profound wisdom teachings in Buddhism. And so I pulled the teaching out, and I was looking over it, and I thought, this is not a Sunday talk, especially not on Mother's Day. So I actually put that off to the side, and I'm actually going to talk about Mother's Day, if you don't mind. Partly because, I thought I remembered the story of Mother's Day. I was like, oh, you know, it's got an interesting history. It was started in response to World War I, and, you know, da-da-da. And so I looked it up online, and I was wrong. I don't know where I got that idea from, but I think I probably was mixing it up with another holiday. I had watched a film when I was in graduate school. I took a film class, one film class. It was a great class. And at the end of the film was a Busby Berkeley musical. Do you guys know who Busby Berkeley was? He did those just amazing dance sequences that were like the dancers were part of some glorious machine that was unfolding and constantly creating interesting images. And at the end of this, Berkeley had created some interesting thing with a conveyor belt and people moving on this past really sad images of mothers weeping about their sons who had been lost in war. It was a very touching anti-war statement at the end of what was really a fairly lighthearted musical. And for some reason, I associated that with Mother's Day. But Mother's Day actually started before World War I. The first Mother's Day, the modern Mother's Day. So I also realized, and this isn't a surprise, that motherhood and mothers have been celebrated going back to antiquity, but the modern Mother's Day, the one that we know of that takes place at this time of year, the first one was in 1908. It was started by a woman named Anna Jarvis. And Anna Jarvis had actually been trying to get Mother's Day established as a holiday since 1905. And that was the year her mother, Ann Jarvis, passed away. And her mother sounded like a remarkable woman. She was a peace activist, and she worked with soldiers on each side of the Civil War, helping them. And she had established something called, let's see if I get that, Mother's Day Work Clubs. And they were groups that were devoted to discussing public health issues. So she was kind of an activist in a way. And when she passed away in 1905, her daughter, Anna Jarvis, wanted to honor her mother. And she also wanted to honor motherhood, the work that mothers do that goes unacknowledged, certainly at that time, and I think still does. So she wanted to establish that holiday. So in 1908, she finally had her first Mother's Day in West Virginia. So that was the first state. And I guess the church where this service was held, where they were celebrating Mother's Day, if you go there, there's a plaque talking about how the first modern Mother's Day was celebrated at this church. By 1911, so I want you to think, you know, Ann Davis, Anna's mother, was a go-getter and did some stuff. So Anna was no slouch because by 1911, every state was observing Mother's Day. 3 years later, through her tireless effort, she got all states to celebrate Mother's Day. And then by 1914, it had actually been signed, declared a national holiday by Woodrow Wilson. And I will say, this is in the face of the fact that in 1908, only 6 years before, when Anna Jarvis tried to get Mother's Day established as a national holiday, Congress blew it off, laughing, look, if we establish a Mother's Day, then we're going to have to establish Mother-in-Law's Day. You know, kind of attitude you're getting in Congress in those days. So they were going to have none of it. 6 years later, it's a national holiday. Now, to me, this is where the story actually really gets interesting, and this is the part that I wanted to kind of focus on. Because at the moment that it becomes a national holiday, Anna Jarvis kind of declares war on Mother's Day, which is really weird because she spends all of this time and energy getting this holiday established. And the first thing I think that happened was she felt Woodrow Wilson took all the credit for it, and she got really mad about that. So that was problem number one. But what really happened was then over the course of the next decade, she saw Mother's Day, let's see if you see this one coming, she saw it becoming commercialized. She was like, well, what's going on? That card companies, greeting card companies were kind of moving in and creating Mother's Day cards, and everyone was buying Mother's Day cards for their moms. The candy companies were getting involved and selling candy to people to give to their moms as gifts. Some of the major florists were selling Mother's Day bouquets, and we're familiar with all this. And she actually really did not like that at all. The commercialization of Mother's Day was, to her, against the spirit of what Mother's Day was. Because for her, Mother's Day was about really expressing your genuine feelings to your mother about her and about motherhood and about family. And so the commercialization of it sort of takes the personal, honest, intimate aspect of it away. And suddenly you have somebody stepping in between. And I'd say it's even a little bit worse than that, because you can start to see then that when, say, card companies come in and they're starting to sell their cards, they have to compete with the other card companies. So they have to create, I guess, the ultimate real expression of what Mother's Day is all about. And then they say, buy our cards. We're really the ones who are expressing what Mother's Day is all about. And you get this kind of battle about who's really, truly, fully, most beautifully expressing what Mother's Day is all about. And then perhaps the people who are on the receiving end of this start thinking, yeah, there are certain things I'm going to expect to hear on Mother's Day, certain things that I think are the right, true, beautiful, meaningful things to say on Mother's Day, and I better hear those things. And I do have a variation of that. This is on Father's Day, it involves my stepfather. And I will not say anything bad about my stepfather. I am ashamed to say I have said too much about the guy who raised me. So I'm not going to say anything bad, but I'll just say he was difficult to have a relationship with. and he was for pretty much everyone. You know, he was just one of those guys. He had a very short fuse, and so he could go off at any moment. So when you had to pick Father's Day cards, I didn't want to just pick the flowery. I wanted this, something that kind of expressed somewhat my relationship with this guy. And I'm not kidding. I would go to store after store, and I would look for one that just parsed it down to like the few things that I felt could be expressed and be honestly expressed. And what was interesting is that's pretty much the way everybody's cards to my stepdad looked, except for 1 year. I think my younger brother had not bought the card until the last day. And so I think all that was left were those big expensive cards that have the giant poems in them, you know? And so he bought one of those and he gave it to our stepdad. And stepdad went through and he was reading all the cards out loud. He'd read them out loud. Most of them he could read in like a second. And then he got to my younger brother's and he read this big, long poem. And he looked up and he said, now that's a Father's Day card. How come the rest of you don't get me something like that? So those cards can kind of create an expectation. What is it that this is supposed to be about? And I'll tell you right now, the cards themselves, we can't blame them. This is human nature. All you have to do is think about your classic literature. Think about King Lear. You remember the beginning of King Lear? So King Lear is this old king. By the way, there's a production of it in New York. And Glenda Jackson is playing King Lear. And she's supposed to be remarkable in it. So if any of you are going out to New York, I would see that in a heartbeat. But anyhow, so at the beginning of King Lear comes out. And he announces, to the surprise of everyone, that he's done being king. I'm kind of done with this. So here's the deal. He has three daughters, and he asked each of them, tell me how much you love me, and then you'll get a portion of the kingdom. And the first daughter says, I looked it up, and it's, in essence, you know, it's what you would expect. So you're really great. Actually, what she says is, you're so great, I really can't put it into words, but that's how great you are. I mean, you're magnificent. And Lear is very pleased with that. And so he moves on to the next daughter. And so the first daughter is Goneril. The next daughter, he moves to Regan. Regan, basically, she honestly all but uses the word ditto. She says ditto, but more. Same thing Goneril said, but more. That's how I feel about you. And Lear goes, pretty good, pretty good. Then he moves on to his youngest daughter, the daughter he loves the most, and the daughter who I think loves him the most, Cordelia. And he comes to her and he says, well, now what do you have to say? And she says, nothing. That's actually what she said, nothing. And that doesn't make him very happy at all. And he says, nothing will come of nothing. And he keeps badgering her. She keeps saying, I can't say my love to you. I can't say anything. And so he disowns her. And he gives his kingdom to the other two daughters. There's expectations. Woo! Right? He's expecting to hear what the first two daughters say to him. And of course, if you know the play, the first two daughters turn on him. Once they get his power, they just turn on him. And the results aren't pretty. So we don't need cards to kind of make us expect to hear certain things, but the cards will play on that. The holiday, the commercialization of the holiday will play on our weaknesses, will play on what it is that we want. Perhaps we want to feel better or something, and they'll prey on that. And that's what Anna Jarvis was responding to. So I'm not saying don't buy your mom a Mother's Day card. I'm just saying this is why Anna Jarvis was against it. It got in the way of what she really wanted. She said, write a letter to your mother. Or I would say, write a poem to your mother. That's what she said. Make it heartfelt. Make it, again, intimate. That kind of intimacy where you're showing your understanding of this person. Make it honest. Now I say make it honest, and it doesn't mean you have to get nasty. So sometimes people hear, oh, we're gonna get honest here. And that means that all the knives are gonna come out, and look out, there's gonna be some bloodletting. As I remember from an episode of The Simpsons. And The Simpsons really was, at least for a long stretch of its run, it was one of the great teachers in American culture. And I remember Marge was going to be a realtor, and she was going to sell this house in which a family had been murdered. So it was called the Murder House, and nobody could sell this house, and Marge was going to sell it. And she had Ned Flanders come over, and if you guys know who Ned Flanders is, he's the Christian guy that lives next door to The Simpsons, real squeaky clean kind of guy. And Marge is trying to, like, keep it hidden what's happened in that house. Anyhow, I'm saying all this only because she thinks she needs to be honest whenever she sells a house. So nobody's buying it at first. And the person who trains her says, look, Marge, there's the truth. And then there's the truth. And he tells her to use the truth with the quotation marks. So there's that truth that when people here get honest, you don't, you know, got to get honest, right? You don't have to do that. That honesty she's talking about, that is actually, we don't have to go to truth or truth. We don't have to go there. That is the way we tend to break the world up. But honesty can be something very different. It can be an openness rather than thinking about, you know, the bad truth or the good truth. You can just be there and be open. And there's honesty in that. It's just honesty in the presence of being with someone. You don't even have to say anything if you really don't want to. Of course, that can get weird too, so I'm not saying don't say anything, right? You show up and I was at actually a family gathering like that once. It wasn't my family, it was at somebody else's gathering. Everybody out, they just went to separate rooms and they just sat quietly. Well, one guy watched One guy was, I don't know, 27, 28 years old, and he was watching some terrible cartoon. You know, one of those Saturday morning cartoons where the animation's like... But I'm not saying that either. So it's not be weird, shut your mouth. It's just be open. You know, when conversation needs to arise, be part of the conversation. There's where you can be honest, is just to be there, responding to what's showing up. And really, being perhaps Mother's Day will be this opportunity to really be with your mother, to really be with her, not to be with all the ideas you might have about her, good or bad, but just to be with your mother and to really fully know your mother. I remember how late it was in my life when I finally saw my mom in a different way than just as my mom. Up to that point, she'd always been mom. She'd just always been mom, and so it had sort of built-in stuff to it. And I just thought of her that way, and I remember somebody saying, you know, your parents will always be your parents. And this is true, but it was that moment when I actually realized, full human being, that was my mom. And like I said, it was pretty late in my life, and it was actually late in her life. So she was ill with cancer, and that's when I finally saw her. I really finally saw her. And I don't know that it had anything to do with the cancer. It may have, but it really was just about the way I was spending time with her and what we were doing and what we talked about. You know, I had seen things in my mom. You'll see those facets of a person. And I know that, you know, when my mom was showing up, there was a lot that was showing up there. Because she would talk about it with us sometimes, and you could see it. So when she was a teenager, she was a really good athlete. She was a really good athlete. So when they would do backlot football, for example, she was the one that every team wanted. Because she could tackle really well, she could run really well, she could catch the ball really well. So she's the person they wanted. But when she was going to high school, in the part of the country that I lived anyhow, she couldn't be an athlete in high school. She could only do it in the neighborhood. So she could be an athlete in the neighborhood, but when it came to being in high school, she had to be a cheerleader, which my mom didn't really mind. She enjoyed being a cheerleader, but she wanted to be on the baseball team, or she wanted to be on a football team. That's what she really wanted to do, and she couldn't do that. And she did tell me that she thought that was unfair. And by the time that I was in high school, there were starting to be girl athletic programs. So things were changing a little bit. But I saw that. That was part of my mom, that there was this part of herself that she really couldn't express because of the culture that she grew up in. And that was a part of who was showing up. And my mom was also blind. I think some of you know that. She wasn't entirely blind, but she was mostly blind. So she could, you know, make out outlines, but she couldn't, like if she saw me standing in a room, she might not know who I was. She might be able to figure it out, but she might not be able to figure it out unless we talked to each other. So she didn't have great sight. She could not read anything. I don't think, she went blind when she was in high school. It was a neurological disorder, and it's one that's not uncommon. You know, suddenly an adolescent might just start losing their sight. They might go entirely blind or just lose some of their sight. My mom lost most of her sight. And I don't think she was able to read at all after that until she got to be middle-aged and the kids were leaving the house and she wanted to finish the college degree that she'd started back in, you know, the early 50s, or I guess it was the late 50s. And so she went to a local vo-tech to get a degree in occupational therapy, to be an occupational therapist assistant. And I remember, again, that blindness. I didn't really think of my mom as being blind because she just did stuff all the time. And you knew that the way she did stuff, she was doing it because she was blind. Like she made, for Christmas, she made tons of candy, like a lot of it. And some of it was candy that required, well, most people when they make it, they use thermometers. the way my mom did it is she'd stick her hand into the stick her finger into the hot corn syrup, which just was crazy. And she'd also use something called the that was a method where you'd put corn syrup into cold water and then you'd test the corn syrup there. But usually she already knew what stage the corn syrup was in just by sticking her finger in the hot corn syrup. So she did things like that. You know, she could move around pretty easily by sound and by the feeling of stuff under her feet. And I say all that because it was hard for me sometimes to remember she was blind just because she did stuff so remarkably. And so it was a surprise to me when she went to that VOTEC. And one of her teachers just said, and you remember, this is a while ago, this is 35 years ago or so. But one of her teachers just said, you can't take a class here. You're not equipped to take a class. And my mom did not take that at all in any way other than as a challenge. So she went ahead and got an A in the class, and the teacher apologized. And was there at her graduation ceremony. Get a little choked up there. So I'd seen all of this before. But there was just a point when I really fully saw my mom. I can't even explain it. I couldn't enumerate to you all the ways that I saw her because that's not how I saw her. I didn't see her as a collection of all these things. I suddenly just went, oh, wait a minute. There's a person here. I can't explain it, but it was that openness. It was just seeing my mom in her fullness. And it wasn't all glorious. You know, some of it wasn't so pretty, but it was a full person. And I don't know if in part the lateness, I mean, I was in my late 20s or probably early 30s. This is what I'm describing. It was that long before I finally had that awareness. And I don't know if the reason it took that long is because it was a mother-son relationship. I don't know. I don't want to impose that kind of thing on there. But I will say that my mom's relationship with her mom was a lot different than my brother's relationship. We were like oafs. She had three weird oafs for sons. And I do know, she told me that when she was having kids, she kept waiting for the daughter to show up. So first was my first brother, and she said, well, the next time she got pregnant, she's going, well, this one's going to be a girl, and then I came along, and then the next time she goes, this one's going to be a girl, and then my third brother came along, and we all turned out to be really odd kids. For somebody who was athletic, I was thinking she was probably hoping one of us would be athletic, one of us would be. We were all so unathletic that we were sort of anti-athletic, and we tried. I mean, I was on... Believe it or not, I was on a basketball team once. I was on a football team. Football team, I got the award for comedian of the team. I did wrestling and I don't know what. I did all kinds of stuff to try to make my parents happy and to hope that I could find some kind of sport that would work. My older brother was a cross-country runner, and he wasn't so bad at it, but you know what he'd do after he'd go out running practice? As soon as he was done running, he'd pull out the cigarette back and light up a cigarette. So, we were odd. We were odd sons. But my mom, on the other hand, her relationship with her mother was very different. Every day, every day, she would call her mom and talk to her for like an hour to 2 hours. Every day. Somebody was laughing about that. She said, what if nothing happened between like the 2 days? Does she start talking about the phone conversation she had the day before? Like, do you remember that phone conversation we had yesterday? You remember that the first thing we talked about was, and I was like, I don't know. I used to hear one side of those conversations and that just astonished me. But that was the kind of relationship she had with her mom. So she had a very different kind of relationship. And the thing that was weird about my mom's calls, if I can just add this, we lived in a small town in Wisconsin. Now, granted, it wasn't this. We didn't live in Mayberry RFD or anything like that. But my grandma, for whatever reason, had a party line. I don't even know if people know what party lines are anymore. Yeah, party lines were phone lines where multiple phones used the same phone line. So my grandma and her neighbor and her neighbor's neighbor, and it was about four or five different families all shared the same phone line. So sometimes you'd be at grandma's house and you need to make a phone call. You'd pick it up and the phone would be busy. That would be from a different household. And my mom told me that grandma had that phone line as late as she did because she liked listening in on other people's conversations. So my mom would call her every night, and they had that kind of intimate relationship. But I didn't quite have that. So I got along with my mom, but I didn't really quite have that sort of intimacy with her until way later. And I think it's an issue that we all have. It doesn't necessarily have to be with our moms, with others in general. Knowing people who are part of our lives and those obviously who aren't, maybe not part of our lives or who just kind of intersect our lives. But it's so easy not to see that other person, to really see them. We get ideas about people pretty quickly and pretty easily. And some of that is, you know, it's cultural. We'll see somebody and we make an immediate judgment, if you will, about who they are. And then we might start to respond just out of that. I remember when I was a young guy, I used to wear vintage clothing. You know, it was just so, I just had a certain look to me. It was all very secondhand. And then I had my hair all piled up. I was using Tom Waits as my fashion designer. So my hair was all piled and I had this weird looking beard that nobody was growing beards like that back then. Now everybody's got weird looking beards, but it was just like a line of hair going down my chin. And then it had a little cloud of hair down here, and nobody had beards like that except Tom Waits. So, you know, I remember I'd walk across the street, and then the people in the cars would be like locking their door. Just, but they'd do it really slowly, like, okay. Because I lived in like inner city neighborhoods too, so there was that added dimension to it. So we see people and we make judgments, we have ideas, and then we actually might act out of those. And maybe we don't do that so much, but once we start to talk to somebody, we start to get ideas. I made the mistake of telling my mother-in-law that somebody she knows voted for Donald Trump. And I think that that's the end of that relationship. You know, so you get ideas about somebody, and then that becomes your relationship. You actually start to think, oh, I know this person now. I know who they are. And we don't allow that person to just be who they are. That's the same thing with my mom. I just had ideas. And so I just never really could be generous enough to let her be who she was. And the person that we meet, they're really, if you think about it, they're new every time we see them. Because the conditions in which they're showing up, the circumstances, are always changing. They're always changing. Which, of course, doesn't mean that we've never met them before. So when we talk to somebody, we have the new meeting with them, our new encounter with them, includes all of our previous encounters. But what we tend to do is in those previous encounters, we get an idea of somebody, and that's how we go, oh, yeah, that she said that to me 5 years ago. I remember that. I don't know if you guys know, have this in your life, but it's part of my life where I don't know necessarily the good things. Though if somebody says something really good about me, I'll remember that. But it's the bad ones where you go, okay, they said that about me. And then, you know, it's 10 years later, and that's still part of the way you're interacting with that person. So instead of just letting go of that and letting that person show up as they are, and that's part of your interaction, you know, maybe you have to talk about it. I don't know. That's going to be up to you. It may be something you need to talk about. I hate to keep bringing pop culture up, but I've been listening to a podcast called Heavyweight. I don't know if anyone's heard this. It's a really interesting show, and it really is kind of about that. It's about people who are hanging on to something that happened in their lives. The one I just listened to is about this girl who had been teased so badly at her school, she went to another school. Next year, imagine that, being teased so badly, you just have to move to another school. And then within the first few weeks of being at the new school, her bullies came to her house and rang her doorbell, and she just panicked, so she just ducked and hid. And all these years now, she's been going, why did they want to see me? What were they doing? Why were they on my front porch? Did they want to tease me some more, or were they concerned about me? Why was I such a coward? And she was really hard on herself. Why was I such a coward? So what the show does is the show producer says, I think you need to find out. So he gets the people to go confront their past. So maybe you need to do that. Maybe if you're hanging on to that insult or whatever, it's time to talk about it. I don't know. I can't say for sure. You've got to look in your own heart and see what the situation requires. But stop hanging on to that. And then that person, you're seeing them through that closed fist. But open that up. That's how we truly see each other, is just to be open to what's showing up. Our tendency to grab hold is, there's a famous story. It's actually a story that's told in many cultures, but there is a Buddhist story of this that gets at this idea. You know about the blind man and the elephant? So in the Buddhist version, I guess a king invites the blind men in the kingdom to the capital, to the palace actually, and asks them to describe an elephant. And so the blind men are feeling the elephant, and the particular things they feel in the Buddhist version, I'm not familiar with all of them, but one who's feeling the elephant's head says, oh, the elephant is a pot. And one that's feeling the ear says, oh, the elephant is a winnowing basket. And the one who feels the tusk says, oh, it's a plow. We all know that, right? And then people are hearing these varying accounts of this elephant. They're like, no, it's not a winnowing basket. It's a plowshare. They say, start fighting amongst one another about who has the true idea of what the elephant is. And they'll fight about that because they've grabbed one aspect, one experience of the whole, and they take that to be truth, and they hang on to that truth, and that's the way they're going to not only see the world, but they're going to argue that that's the way the world is. And the Buddha's got a concluding verse in this particular teaching. He says, oh, how they cling and wrangle, some who claim for preacher and monk the honored name. So in particular, he was talking about these sectarian clashes, how religious leaders have the truth and then fight over it. But we can see this just in our daily lives. For quarreling, each to his view they cling. Such folk see only one side of a thing. And again, that's what we can do with other people. We get an idea. We have one kind of experience with them. We cling to that, and we're not open to that person. What's happening, of course, is we're getting in the way there. We're thinking, oh, I got slighted by that person. It's really all about us. When we think it's about the other person, we think, well, she wouldn't have said that. But we got insulted. Ourself got pinged or dinged or however you want to put it. But we felt some harm. We felt some hurt in that initial exchange. We're hanging on to that. And so, again, we're showing up, but not fully showing up. It's this ego self that's showing up. You've heard this in Zen teachings. They talk about the small self, the ego self. Steve will say small S self. That's the one that's full of ideas. Full of ideas. You could say that's the self that's full of itself. And it wants the world to meet it on its terms. So it wants the things it doesn't like to just stay away or shut up or whatever. It wants the things that it likes to come forward, to be here. It wants to be pleased. It wants to feel safe. And there's nothing wrong with any of that stuff, but that becomes the center of the universe then, and that self is what's showing up. And we can actually do something about that. We can see that that self is showing up. And again, we don't have to be owned by that small self. We can listen to what it's saying, and we can evaluate whether or not, again, what it is we need to do at that particular point. But we don't have to behave from that. We don't have to make that snarky comment or keep one part of ourselves compartmentalized because of the interaction we're having. We can really just open ourselves up. And in doing that and opening ourselves up, that other person opens up. It may not even be they're not doing anything, but they open up because we see them flowering. We see the flowering of that self. And so in opening up, we really see opening up of everything. So what happens when we are open then to that other person? It is like true self, this true self, the self that we are, that is not this small self, that is not this egoistic self, meeting itself. And it's meeting itself as two people coming together. And it can be a really wonderful thing. And so I think about when I think of Mother's Day, this can be an opportunity for, yeah, go see your mom, give her the card, give her the bouquet of flowers, and just be there. Or if the situation is more fraught for you than that, well then, look to your own heart and what needs to be taken care of. What is it that needs to be done? Maybe nothing needs to be done. So you don't always have to meddle around with stuff either. But look to your own heart. Really see how you're showing up. Is it that small self that sees itself as, we just read a chapter in Suzuki, Shunryu Suzuki's Not Always So, called The Boss of Everything. And he means it in this open sense. The boss of everything is really reality. But we could see the boss of everything is that little ego. I'm the boss of everything. Right? Suzuki says, I don't mean that. So what's showing up? What boss is showing up? And we can then respond in that way. And it seems like Mother's Day is one of those days. It just kind of reminds us that we're not alone, that we share this world with others, that we actually are dependent on. We wouldn't be here without having had a mother, right? So what's showing up here is dependent on so much else. It seems like a great day to do that, for the true self to meet the true self. So I didn't want to go on too long. I actually went on a little longer than I thought I was going to. Are there any questions or comments that people have?
Yes, it went on in the book past that they share the same headstone. I think about my mom and dad in a way that they shared certain interests together, like gardening, you know. And I think one way I can honor them is by recognizing this sort of what it's cliche to say, but the Mother Earth, mm-hmm. taking care of God, I feel like I'm taking care of them in a way. In their memory.
Yeah, that sounds wonderful. Thanks for sharing.
Yeah.
Anything else? Cal.
Tibetan teachings, Tibetan Buddhist teachings, everyone has, at one time or the other, been a mother of everyone else.
Yeah.
And every role.
Yeah, think about the wisdom in that teaching, really helping us to see, again, I think, at least, you know, we tend to separate stuff out and say, well, that's a mother and that's, but to really see the way that that's sort of still breaking reality up and not seeing the seamless whole of everything.
Right.
And certainly we don't not recognize that.
Yeah.
You know, the separations that are there. But I think that's a great teaching. Thanks for sharing.
You have to go deeper.
It was a Katagiri teaching today. He's saying that life is deep and we tend to swim on the surface. I thought that was a really great image. Ellen, what were you going to say?
I just, you know, Mother's Day came up and the first thing I thought of was, you know, what was your original face before your parents were born?
Sure.
I mean, not to bring up something so deep, but I think that kind of points to where you were going.
Yeah. What was your original face before your grandparents were born or whatever it is? And that's a question that I think is, I remember the first time I really heard that question, I went, wow. And then I asked somebody else, and of course, if somebody's got an answer, they're going to put in there. Because it's one of those things, if you really listen to the question, there's nothing to be said. It really is just be with that. But you know, I thought it was so profound, I put it on, and here's the commercialization. I threw it right on Facebook. I went, oh, that's really interesting. And then one of my evangelical friends immediately said, well, I know on my face. Well, you know, I just went, oh, yeah, that's right. People do have answers for that. But if you really listen to the question, it's not something you can answer without kind of getting it wrong. You know, so. Thank you, Ellen. Anything else? Well, thank you again for coming here, and have a wonderful Mother's Day.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.